Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. And in recent years, the global food system has come under increasing pressure as it grapples with rising populations, shifting climates and rapid technological advancements. Now, with the value of $10 trillion and the responsibility for a third of global emissions, the stakes here are high for the global food system. So what does this mean for the food in our plates, the waste in our bins and the future of our planet? So David McGee, PwC ESG leader, who has been closely analysing these challenges and opportunities, joins me now. First of all, David, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks very much.
Now, the population is rising, the climate is changing, technology is evolving, but let's look at an issue that's going on in our homes right around the world. A quarter, David, a quarter of our food produced for human consumption goes uneaten. Why?
Yeah, there is the whole issue of food waste and loss is a massive part of the problem, right? Like, we could actually make huge improvements if we could just fix that farm to fork value chain and stop that loss going on. And it's a whole range of issues, right? So we've had upsizing of portion packs and sizes of retail packs. That's been a problem. So that's to give value to the consumer and counter inflation. But actually, very often we overbuy and we want to get rid of. We misplan. We are a nation and a demography that frequently will change their minds and switch what they want to do. And you've got to react to that. And then you end up with food left over. And sometimes we just make mistakes. We overbuy. We buy the wrong things. We change our minds on something. So it is a very real problem. But actually, it's not just in the home. It's the full value chain all the way through, right? 30% of the overall calories get lost from farm to fork one way or another. And it's a much bigger problem. The problem, as I've described it there in the answer to Susan, is all a kind of a Western developed world kind of answer, right? The problem south of the equator tends to be much more to do with refrigeration, both in the value chain and in the home. And how do you keep food fresh? So it's a problem.
Do you know what I do sometimes, David, is I will open the fridge and I will take a picture and I'll ask ChatGPT what I can do with what's there.
Very interesting. Yeah, there's a technology blending to kind of solve how we feed ourselves. I love it.
There you go. I have an on-call food consultant in the phone at the moment. But you mentioned there about this as a Western developed world issue, right? Let me bring you a Western developed world solution. Ozempic. We had Ben Spencer, who's the science editor of the Sunday Times, on the show a little while ago about the growth of this. It's mentioned in the PwC report all around this area as well. Would that solve an awful lot of the problem? Is basically you suppress appetites, people demand less. Would that actually genuinely help what we're talking about here today?
GLP-1 will certainly, and all of the kind of various brand name drugs that sit underneath it will absolutely kind of change the configuration, right? So we're seeing very significant percentage of the US population already taking some form of GLP-1 drug.
One in eight have tried it, yeah.
Yeah. So what that will do is shift and vary the demand. So already we're seeing a move away from high sugar, high salt foods and away from bigger portion sizes as people adjust their own personal eating habits. The question is, at what point do you have large swathes of the population on it on a regular basis? So we're seeing lots of doctors saying this is a hugely important drug or suite of drugs or taxonomy of drugs that can help with a very real problem. But are we going to see kind of like vast bulks of the population on? So I think it'll change things. We're already seeing food manufacturers and food retailers trying to react to it. The problem, and I know we've jumped straight to the developed Western, one of the problems we have is the misdistribution of the calories that we produce at the moment. So forget the growth problem, right? But we're consuming too many calories north of the equator and not enough calories south. So if you take the 8 billion people on the planet today, 800 million of those people are living in some form of food deficit or food poverty. So another 1.4 billion people are at risk from year to year because of the impacts of climate change on things like flood or drought or geopolitical events. Putting them temporarily or for a season at risk of food poverty. So we've got, when we did our modelling and thought about, we weren't thinking just about the growth of the global population from 8 to 9.5 or 10 billion. We were also thinking, how do we feed everybody equitably? And how do we close that deficit on the roughly 2.4 billion people who are either in food poverty or at risk of it?
Or indeed who aren't born yet, as you say, in line with the rising population. Often, David, when we talk about things like this, there's a sense of it's all over and it's a sense of debilitating despair. And I don't want that to characterise today's conversation. So as I read the global report from PwC about this, a couple of things really stood out to me. One is this, is that meat and milk alone account for 60% of total food system emissions, and all regions reduced the emissions intensity of cow's milk from 2000 to 2020. Specifically, Europe did so by 40%. So can you tell us other tangible progress that has really made a difference that has happened?
I think there's been huge progress made. Like the whole food sector, from input providers to the farmers to the processors, have made huge strides in trying to... They know this is a problem, right? And if I leave global food production as it is today and do nothing with it and fix every other problem we have on sustainability, how we move ourselves, how we build things, how we make things, how we produce power, if I fixed everything else and just let things carry on, food would actually grow and produce as many emissions in 2050 as we are today, right? So we've got to fix that problem. It's a complex problem to solve, but there's been real, huge, very significant attempts to address this issue. And actually, at the forefront of that has been some of the companies here in Ireland. Companies like Tierlawn, companies like Carberry have been doing practical investments on the ground to help trials, to help pilots, working with some of the academic institutions we have, and then bringing those pilot learnings out to farms to put it into place on real farms. Emissions are coming down. And you know, before you jump to this question, in all of the modelling we did and a lot of the academic modelling that the UN and other institutions have done, there is absolutely a role for animal-based proteins in the future diet, right? So,
because I do want to ask you about this, yes. Yeah.
So everything we looked at, like there is a real importance in terms of calories from marine life, and good news for Ireland, there is absolutely still a role for dairy and animal-based protein in the future diet. The configuration changes. We've all got to eat more plant-based, but there are technological and farming solutions coming and already showing demonstrable improvements in that emissions profile.
If I can just paraphrase what you're saying there, I think where you're going is that we do need artificial meat-tasting products that aren't meat-based so that we can increase the amount of plant-based food in our diet. And I have to say, I don't see that there yet in the market. Like, if I go to nut butter and I order plant-based chorizo, that's probably the only place that I can go where I would actually taste it and where it tastes in that way. Is the market, and what I mean by the market is the supply of foods like this really out there that people want, David?
No, but like the markets respond to market demands, right? So I think what will happen here is as people become more aware of it, but also we globally, right? This isn't just an Irish phenomenon. We have an expectation of cheap food. Right. And part of the challenge for food producers is there is a strong expectation that food and food prices are kept as low as possible. And that's a real challenge for food producers, right, who in some cases are not getting the full economic return that they should on livestock or per acre. But what will happen is as we see that balance, as we see education get right, as we see people want to naturally gravitate, the market will come and fulfill those solutions. Right now, there's not enough, you're right, there's not enough consumer demand to create the kind of the variety and the range. But those products are getting better and better and better. And again, some of our Irish companies are doing amazing work in terms of additives and ingredients and flavourings to help produce better and better quality products that will hit at the right price point and help the consumer address this very real problem.
And this is really something to watch, I think, in future diets as time goes on. But let's stick with meat that is actually meat, because I was really struck by this. You know the way always in conversations around environmental impact, they say reduce your consumption of red meat. But in your report, you actually really pin it down. The emission intensity of beef is up to 32 times that of chicken. So clearly there needs to be a reduction there in the consumption of livestock. So when it comes to where Ireland's future offering from an agricultural point of view comes, what do you say to people who are involved in the farming industry here about what they need to be doing to move in line with what the consumer wants and where government is going?
So go back to my central thesis that I believe there is no kind of scenario where we move to 100% plant-based diet.
You don't see that.
I just don't see that as a not in my lifetime, I don't see that as a configuration, right? So, or a scenario. So I think a couple of things happen there. One is that there is lots of technological advances happening here in Ireland, in the US Midwest, in the Netherlands, where people are looking at trying out things with different feedstocks, trying out things with emissions capturing devices, trying out different housing mechanisms. It doesn't suit us here, where we like to have cattle out and grass fed. So the first thing is, I think that 32X will change over time as the technological and the breeding advances, and as we profile the DNA of cattle, I think we'll get to lower and lower emissions over time. So that's one thing. The second thing is, then the consumer will make choices, right? And the consumer will say, if I want to move and shift here, we have, if you look both on dairy and beef, we have a very strong global brand. And I think if those products move to a situation where people are eating a little bit less of them, but when they want to eat them, they want to get something really high quality, I think that's a real place that we can, and a real space that our producers can play in.
Can I just maybe bring our conversation a bit broader from where we're going to the individual choices that consumers are making and how markets respond to that? Because, of course, one of the lines of service in PwC is advisory and very much focusing on consulting. And the report says, and if I could ask you really to turn this into English for me, please, David, right? The report says that we need to make traditional linear models into integrated circular ones that prioritise climate resilience, resource optimisation and data-enabled transparency. David, what does that mean?
Okay, so let me draw two important things out of that statement, right, of beautiful consulting speak, right? So the first thing is the current value chain for food is completely linear. It starts here and it goes right to the end. And what we've got to do is figure out ways to make sure we are capturing. I talked to an Irish producer today who wants to move away from, and he's a livestock producer, wants to move away from just looking at what is the value of the cuts of meat I'm getting off the animal to what is the total value of the animal and how do I maximise that? And what's the total value of the land that the animal is standing on and how do I maximise my return on that? And actually look at all of that, look at the waste that's coming off, looking at what's left over both on the packaging and the product and make sure we're cycling that all the way back through. So that's about changing from the linear piece. I think the key to us reconfiguring the global value chain for food, food is a massively fragmented, if you think about food globally, unlike a lot of other industries, there's very little concentration at any choke point where you can say, that's where I can really influence. Massively fragmented. And data is hugely important. If you look at the efforts that companies and farmers are making to move us towards regenerative agriculture, data is hugely important for that in terms of being able to track at field level what's going on in the soil, what's going on in the water, what's going on with the crops, what's the positioning of the tractor, precision tractor move. So actually that data and pulling all that data together, but being prepared, data transparency is important, being prepared to share that with other actors in the value chain so we can cut out the food waste and loss, mm-hmm. and actually get a tighter integration between the demand signals out at the retailer and what I'm taking off the farm.
I wish people could see the way you're talking with this, because you're a great man to talk with your hands and you're describing A to B here. But David, one thing that annoyed me, right, when I was reading through the global report.
Only one.
As I was reading through the global report and then I read through the Irish report, of which you were a key architect of, right, is that all the solutions are there. All the solutions are there. They're on paper. And even when I looked at the various different references to the global paper, they're all there. So, David, why do we still have people hungry in the world if the solutions are all there?
So I think, and I must go back and look at the report, but I'm not sure all of the solutions are there. If I look at other challenges like energy, there's some challenges on batteries, but we understand a lot about what we do. There are still areas of food, you touched earlier on livestock emissions, where we don't have an answer that gets me to zero, right? So there's lots of the answer there and lots of things we need to do. The problem comes down, like a lot of the challenge on climate change and sustainability, the resources are misallocated, right? So the individuals, the companies and the nations that have the money to potentially invest in this have competing demands for it, number one. But the areas that really need to spend big money don't have the money to do it. So we need to figure out, and the last two COPs have grappled with that problem significantly. How do you start reallocating some of the resources to try to make this happen faster?
As I say, it might be simple, but it's not easy. And this, absolutely, I mean, I don't mean to oversimplify the complexity of this, but it is the will of the coordinated parties to actually make this happen. And you have laid it all out there in both of those. Really want to thank you for coming in today. David McGee, PwC ESG leader. And let's talk again about this. And I'll be watching out now for both waste and the plates, what's on them in future. Thanks very much, David.
Thank you.